I'm joined here by Nathan Baker, Terrestrial Resources Supervisor here in the central part of the state. Nathan and I will kind of tag team on this short presentation today, and I'm going to give you kind of an overview of our grazing management program on our game production areas from a more of a statewide basis, some facts and figures there. And then Nathan is going to focus in his portion of the presentation more on the what we refer to as the Title VI lands or the game production areas along the Missouri River reservoirs in South Dakota. Those are the properties that were acquired from the federal government through the Corps of Engineers back a number of years ago, and Nathan will have a little bit of history on that for you as well. So to start out, again, this is some facts and figures about game production areas in general. I showed this same slide yesterday, just some summary of what we own for game production areas. I think one of the important things to keep an eye on is, you know, we mentioned we have 285,000 acres, and of that, about half of it is grasslands. And that's important to note, because when we're talking about our grazing program on game production areas, you know, we're referring to these grasslands, whether they're native prairie rangelands or you know, prairie reconstruction projects or planted grasslands. These are the sort of grasslands that we're talking about. So it's a significant portion of our game production areas, and it's important to understand too that when, you know, grassland systems evolved under a disturbance regime, and that is, you know, historically it was principally grazing by large ungulates or large herds of bison and fire. And so those are the sort of tools that are necessary to effectively manage existing grasslands to keep them healthy and vigorous. So when we talk about grazing management on game production areas, there's kind of a collection of guiding principles that our managers try to go by. And I'll just go through these briefly. Grazing management is an effective tool to help achieve long-term wildlife conservation goals. And again, this is, again, grazing is a management tool to manage grasslands, introduce that disturbance that keeps those grasslands healthy and vigorous. Grazing often gets a bad rap. It's not good or bad for wildlife habitat, but rather it can have a positive or negative effect depending on how it's utilized. And that, again, a guiding principle. We need to understand that as we go forth with grazing on our game production areas. Wildlife habitat needs provide the sideboards for developing these biologically sound and defensible grazing strategies. Again, I go back to the management plans that we as an agency prepare for each one of those 719 game production areas. And when our managers and biologists recognize the need for managing that rangeland or those grasslands with grazing, be it grazing, fire, or haying, we set sideboards on, you know, what we're trying to manage for on those game production areas. What are the principal species we're trying to manage for, and what sort of habitat needs do they have? And then how can we use tools like grazing to manage those grasslands within those sideboards? With a lot of different things in wildlife management, careful planning, judicious application, and thorough evaluation are very important. We need to have that feedback loop of applying that grazing management and then going out and evaluating. Are we hitting the mark? Are we doing what we need to be doing on those grasslands? And so that's a very important feedback loop that our managers and our biologists are looking at and figuring out what do we need to do from year to year. Of course, flexibility is essential, and nothing illustrates that more than a year like this, where conditions are in many parts of the state are a lot wetter than they normally are. And our managers, in working with our tenants, have to have some flexibility to adjust grazing, whether that means a little more, a little less, whatever it might be, but we have to be flexible in how we apply that grazing. And that's one of the principal advantages of working with the tenants that we have, is, you know, a lot of times we've got the same tenants on these game production areas that we've had for years, and they understand where we're trying to go with management of those game production areas, and they also accept the fact that, you know, we might be coming to them asking them for some flexibility, and it's a good working relationship we have with these folks, and so flexibility is extremely important. And lastly, there's no cookbook. You know, we continue to learn, improve, and apply the latest knowledge on grazing management. Our managers are really astute at keeping up on some of the emerging science with grazing management. And in fact, I think a lot of them, if not a majority of our managers and biologists, have attended the South Dakota Grassland Coalition's grazing school that's conducted annually. So we have folks going out and actually taking training on grazing management and continuing to learn and evaluate what we're doing. Our senior private lands biologist, Tim Olson, is working with a consultant right now, Crossroads Ranch Consulting, if you've heard of them. But he's bringing that consulting firm here to South Dakota this coming December, and we're going to have our private land staff and our public lands managers and biologists attend a session with this consulting firm, and they're going to give us a week-long course in holistic management of grazing. So again, just some efforts that we're making to continue to stay on top of the science and understand what's going on with our grazing program. So here's the summary of what we do on just generally on an annual basis. We enter into on those 285,000 acres, approximately 290 grazing leases on an annual basis. Annually, about 64,000 acres are grazed, and as Nathan will point out here in just a moment, a large portion of that grazing occurs on those Title VI game production areas along the Missouri River. We generate about $225,000 annually in program income off of grazing leases. And our managers are utilizing barter arrangements when applicable to kind of offset the grazing fees. And in a typical barter arrangement would be that perhaps we have a grazing tenant who will do some fence repair, maintenance, or construction for us, and the value of that work that they put in is an offset to their grazing fees. Another example might be a tenant who is grazing a piece of property for us, but will, in lieu of a grazing fee, plant a food plot for us. So we're you know, continuing to achieve those management objectives that we want on that game production area, and we're doing it at in a typical barter arrangement. As far as rates and dates, principally, all of our, for the most part, all of our grazing leases are conducted on an animal unit basis. What you'll see, and Nathan will present this here in a moment, most of those, or there's a fair portion of those grazing leases along the Missouri River reservoirs, those Title VI game production areas, where we're actually on a per acre basis for those rental rates. But as far as animal units, you know, we average about $10. Across the state, it ranges $7.50 to $15. And as you can imagine, as with the grazing season, this varies by latitude and longitude in the state. You know, we have times when we've got cattle on game production areas doing some grazing in perhaps the southeast part of the state, and we're still looking at, you know, a foot of snow on the ground in the north part of the state. So that window of grazing season from April through July, you know, is pretty wide, but that has to do with, you know, typically the part of the state that we're working in. And typically a grazing lease is probably on average about a 30-day period that we're asking that tenant to be in there and do some grazing for us. So I'll let Nathan take over and talk more about the Title VI GPAs.
Okay, as Paul mentioned, the Title VI GPAs is land, you know, along the Missouri River. Essentially, that was transferred under federal legislation under the Water Resources Development Act of 1999, amended in 2000. You can see the transfer dates there from 2006 on the Big Bend project lands, 2007 Lake Oahe, where most of the acres are at, Fort Randall 2008, Gavin's Point 2009. So there was lands that were transferred to the state, and then through to Game Fish and Parks to manage. They're transferred to the Division of Wildlife, you know, for wildlife lands, and then some were also designated as park and recreation areas. But most of them are classified as wildlife lands under the management of the Division of Wildlife. Under those lands that were transferred to the Division of Wildlife within that Water Resource Development Act, it was specifically stated that those lands to be used for fish and wildlife purposes. There's also the latitude for GFP to manage, control, and improve that property on behalf of the state, improving it for the benefits of wildlife and fish. Total acres that were transferred to the Division of Wildlife was just under 80,000 on those four different projects there. So the management goals that we have for the Division of Wildlife on the wildlife lands that were transferred to us and to the state, again following what was laid out in the Water Resource Development Act, is managing them for wildlife purposes. So how can we do that? As Paul mentioned earlier, most of our land is in grassland habitat, and for the most part, we want to keep it in grassland habitat. And so we implement best management practices. Again, those things that staff have learned by going through the grazing schools and the grassland school that's also being put on. I think it started last year. So, you know, how to manage those? What are the best management practices? You know, stocking rates, timing, intensity, water sources, things of that nature. We could also use prescribed fire, haying, noxious weed control, things like that to manage those grassland habitats. As I'll touch on a little bit later in the presentation, here is also cedar tree removal or cedar tree encroachment on some of the lands, especially in the southern end along the Missouri River of the state, like Gregory County, Charles Mix County there. And then interseeding native plant species is something that we're kind of looking at, and again, following some of that, the research that's out there, you know, if we have an area where maybe we don't have a plant community and maybe our options are limited, can we interseed some native species and then maybe graze on top of that, work it in to improve the grassland habitat. We do have a few food plots on the Title VI lands, but most of those or all of them are going to be on areas that were previously disturbed. So if it's intact grassland habitat, native prairie, we're not going to disturb it. It also there's cultural resource concerns on these properties as well. So we're, you know, it would be very difficult to, you know, set a plow and put a food plot in. Tree plantings, like on a lot of our other GPAs, component of winter habitat, we can put that in. In regards to Title VI areas, most of those areas that are suitable for trees have already been planted to trees during kind of the mitigation era when the dams were constructed. You know, the trees, cottonwood forest essentially was flooded out, and then so we tried to mitigate that. And there was actually a mitigation department that, you know, basically planted large blocks of trees on lands that were suitable for that. So most of that has been taken care of for the most part on these lands. And then, you know, kind of wrapping all that up, we want to increase opportunity for sportsmen and sportswomen, and then facilitating access to it. You know, these areas are along the Missouri River breaks. It's kind of steep, rugged country. To try to get people access to that is to try to keep the trails that we do have maintained so people can get into them and use them. And then also the preservation of cultural resources. So there's a lot of cultural resource sites on these lands, and when that was transferred over to us, we assumed some of the responsibility the state did to monitor those cultural resource sites. So we work with the Corps of Engineers, and they send us a list every year. Some are monitored every year, some are every 5 years, some every 3 years, and we're still kind of adjusting that where we go out and have to inspect the site. You know, is it eroding away? Is there looting occurring? Things like that. So that's, you know, part of the management on these Title VI game production area lands. In getting back to grazing specifically on these lands, there's kind of easier to break it down into two types. There's controlled grazing and uncontrolled grazing, and I'll try to explain what that is. So controlled grazing would be where we have a GPA has a boundary fence along it. We're able to rest it, graze it. We can graze it, as Paul mentioned early on, for a short duration, high intensity stocking rate, so on and so forth. We're able to manipulate that to our advantage. Roughly on all the Title VI properties along the river, roughly 25% is under a managed grazing lease, where there's a boundary fence, or we have the ability, working with a tenant, to graze when we want, how we want, and type of duration. There's roughly about it's actually closer to 30% that is not grazed. So 30% of those 80,000 roughly acres that's not grazed, just due to the maybe the location of where it's at, and there's not access or for somebody to get cattle to graze it, or simply that the state of the range condition is kind of the stage that we want it to be at, and we don't need to graze it. Then there's uncontrolled grazing. That would be where there's no boundary fences. And it's generally a long-term grazing lease. And I'll kind of get in to where there's no boundary fences, just to the type of terrain and things that we're dealing with to try and fence some of those. Long-term grazing lease, generally it's a 5-year grazing lease with the same tenant. Generally longer duration, where their property is adjacently bordering the Game Fish and Parks Title VI property. So when they're running their cattle, they're going to go on to ours as well, because we don't have a boundary fence established. And about 50% of the Title VI Division of Wildlife lands are under a long-term grazing lease. So kind of the breakdown of the controlled, uncontrolled grazing. This map here kind of shows, it has a little bit of everything on it as far as controlled grazing, uncontrolled grazing, where we've used prescribed fire, so on and so forth. And so this is just southwest of Chamberlain. That's the White River that's dumping into the Missouri River at the confluence there, referred to as Carpenter GPA. And so what you see on the map is a blue area is a long-term grazing lease, so a 5-year grazing lease where there's no boundary fence that's established, and when the adjoining landowner is grazing their property, they'll essentially be grazing the Game Fish and Parks property as well. And you can see along those blue areas, the Title VI boundaries, they make 90-degree angles, and they twist and turn quite a bit. And going through rugged country with a lot of cedar trees, it's really not conducive to establish a fence in there. And then if we were able to put one in there, it'd probably be enormous amount of money to do it, and then enormous amount of upkeep and cost to keep that fence in good repair every year. The yellow hashed area is just south of the confluence of the White River. There is an area where it's a managed grazing lease. So that area is broken up into essentially three areas, or three pastures, if you will, and it's grazed every third year essentially. And with that particular one, you can see there's kind of some ag fields up on top, and the boundary fence is on the private property, but working with us, they graze just based on their grazing regime. That when they're grazing their stuff, it allows for us to graze ours, and we can control it, where they're not just kicking their cattle out and letting them go, for a long type of duration. The kind of the orange polygon there was a 2019 prescribed fire that we did this spring. So that was that area, or the red hashed areas would be an area that we manage as a game production area. So similar like we would off of the Missouri River, where maybe we have some food plots, or we can control the grazing there and work with the tenants that, we don't want to graze this year, but maybe in 3 years we do want to graze. And some of those, by getting the Title VI transfer, we already had some of that land, the uplands that were already in a GPA, and it just extended to it. So our land continues off the river, so we kind of have that fine boundary where we can have a fence around it. This is just an illustration of kind of that this previous slide, where the blue hashed areas are at, kind of what you're looking at. And in that previous area, I think Commissioner Phillips, we did a grazing tour last fall, I believe, early fall, and kind of looked at some of these areas. And so that's kind of what those are, you know, cedar trees in the background there. And then this is kind of, you know, kind of looking down the river, you know, from the top of the bluffs down, where a lot of those draws are full of cedar trees and encroached and lots of drainages that kind of make it difficult. If our property boundary, you know, cuts mid-slope through there, you know, and makes the 90-degree angles all the way along there, you can see how difficult it would be to exclude some of that area. Here's the grazing rates on the Title VI, the controlled and uncontrolled grazing. As Paul mentioned, for the parcels that we do have control, we manage it as a GPA. It's generally $10 to $12 per animal unit that we're charging. And then the Title VI land where there's uncontrolled grazing, that's on a per acre basis. So you can see that the cost there for each county within Region 2 that I have pulled out there and what the cost is. And so where those rates were developed from, those came from the Corps of Engineer leases. So they previously had grazing leases in place when the lands were transferred to Game Fish and Parks. And so from what I've been told, when those lands were transferred, it was on each parcel. Maybe it was $2.50 on this parcel within, say, Gregory County. Another portion was maybe $5. So each parcel was a different rate. And so to simplify everything, when we got it, we took the lowest rate and the highest rate, threw both of those out, and then averaged the rest of them and came up with a county average. And so one thing that we've been working on for the past several months, and part of that tour that we went on with Commissioner Phillips last fall, was to evaluate our current grazing rates. They're 10 to 13 years old from when they were transferred to us from the Corps of Engineers. Some of the challenges that we have, as I mentioned, many are difficult, if not impossible, to fence along our boundaries. The rugged terrain, cedar tree encroachment, if we were able to put a fence in, could we maintain that fence? And what are the costs associated with that? Many acres aren't able to be grazed due to the cedar tree encroachment or even the soil types, some of the shale hilltops. So there's, you know, it's kind of depends on each parcel and area as far as the quality of the grazing land there. Access to the land is difficult, not only for our sportsmen and public in certain places and us as well, for our staff to get to some of these sites, but also there may only be one adjoining landowner. So, you know, we work with that landowner and have a relationship established with them to, you know, graze on the Title VI property. And then in a lot of areas, some of the landowners, you know, where their property goes right to ours and it's in that type of country, they just want a water source. You know, they're not necessarily concerned about all of the grazing acres where maybe there isn't very many or the quality's not as good due to cedar tree encroachment, but access to the water is kind of a key component for them. And so the new grazing rate calculation that we're kind of working on, or things that we're taking into consideration, is what are the management costs to the department to manage these lands? You know, some of that is, you know, property taxes that, you know, GFP, you know, we pay for the taxes and all the game production areas. So what are those property taxes? So we're evaluating those and getting those numbers. What's the cost to manage the leases, you know, to set up a grazing lease, on those, evaluating sites, write and administer the leases from our habitat staff, and then, you know, to locate and survey pins and define the boundaries, sign the properties, is another component that we work on these lands. And then, you know, as far as managing grassland habitat, as I mentioned, another tool is prescribed fire. And so recently we've coordinated with the South Dakota Wildland Fire to help with burning on a lot of our game production areas, and then it was a type 2 fire that we did on the White River there that I showed earlier, you know, and helping with them to burn that, to improve that rangeland habitat. And then we've also created an MOA with the Mid-Missouri River Prescribed Burn Association. You can see on the map the kind of Lyman County extended through Brewer, Gregory, Charles, Mix counties, where they are very active in fire management and trying to restore the grassland habitat as it pertains to cedar tree encroachment. And so one difficulty that they have is they want to do a burn on their property, but it goes directly into ours, and it's almost impossible to build a fire line on theirs. So we worked with them and South Dakota Wildland Fire to come up with a MOA that allows us to burn with them to improve rangeland habitat. This is just a photo of the prescribed fire that we did with Wildland Fire on our property last year. With that, we'll take any questions.
Does the department have written prescription or rules before it sets a fire for prescribed burn? Or, I mean, what are the criteria? I know that's maybe not the main point of what we're talking about.
But yeah, the department, you know, we as an agency go by the, you might have to help me with the acronym here, Nathan, but the Wildland Coordinating Group, which is basically some national standards. So all our folks who work on prescribed fire, who are on those burn crews, and all the prescriptions that we write, all comply with those national standards, as well as the burn plans that we do are all run through Wildland Fire to ensure that they're, you know, that all the bases are covered with regards to safety, et cetera. But then when you get back to the biology of it or the management aspect of it, that prescription that we're writing, again, it's within the sideboards of what we're trying to accomplish with the habitat management on that particular game production area. What sort of habitat are we trying to create and maintain for what species? And so those prescriptions are written by our managers and biologists to get us to that point. And so that's kind of the approach we use with the burning.
So at the end of the day, before somebody lights a fire, I mean, who makes that decision? Does the secretary make that decision, or does somebody out in the field? Or
those decisions on when to burn are up to that burn crew at that time. Yes.
Okay. Thanks, Commissioner Olson or Commissioner Locken.
Thank you, Commissioner Locken. Here, do you maintain the boundaries on this property? I know you don't have fences in most cases, but do you maintain the property corners and stuff like that?
Yeah, there was a, you know, as we mentioned when we received those properties from the Corps of Engineers, there were a number of those areas that we had under lease at the time. And so we were actually managing those as game production areas under a lease from the Corps. And so signage and boundary control was not an issue on a lot of those properties. But as Nathan pointed out in some of those maps that he showed, you know, in a lot of places that boundary is very narrow, and it's kind of a stair step sort of approach. And one of the efforts that we've made since those transfers are to try to locate many of those survey pins on the corners and get signs up. And as you can imagine, from North Dakota to Nebraska, there's a lot of linear mileage there. And it's job security for our folks. They started up here and they've worked their way down, and they're gonna have to go back up and start over again. It's a constant struggle to keep those signs up and in place. But yeah, that was one of the more important aspects of taking over these lands, is to make sure that folks who are using them know where they're at and know that they're on a game production area. So that was signage was a very important aspect of it, yes.
Commissioner Olson.
Commissioner Olson, back at our May meeting, we rolled out a link on our website that people that had complaints or issues with GPAs could post comments and identify the complaint area. Do we have anything, are you tracking anything as far as complaints regarding grazing and other things that you've had to follow up on?
Well, with regards to the website, the portal that we have for folks to write in and comment on game production area or walk-in area program lands, we have been monitoring that, and we've gotten so far just a handful of comments. Of course, we anticipate those sort of comments, good and bad, of course, to ramp up as hunting seasons roll around and more folks are on the ground seeing things. But with regards to, you know, complaints that we might receive regarding grazing in general, you know, most of what we receive are inquiries from the public. You know, they might call Nathan, or they might call me, or one of our conservation officers, and really not necessarily as much a complaint as, hey, I got questions. Why do I see cows out on this game production area? And so we welcome those opportunities to explain why we're using grazing as a management tool. And I can, you know, I think vast majority of the time, once you take the time to talk to folks and explain why they're seeing what they're seeing and why we're doing what we're doing, there's better understanding, and I think that we're just really able to successfully address those concerns that people have when they do call.
Commissioner Phillips.
Thank you. I was part of the tour that we took that day, and it was very interesting. Just wanted to add one thing concerning the boundaries and the corners and how difficult it is out there to maintain a fence or even to maintain our corners. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the Corps of Engineers kept some land next to the water too, the flood pool or whatever, so we also have a boundary. We have a water line wherever it is. Then there is some core land in there between the water and our property. Then our property, the GPA runs back to the take line, which then borders the private land. So there's literally a boundary on both linears, for both sides of the river, two boundaries on each side. So our boundaries are very long and very complicated. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. The upland boundary that adjoins, in a lot of cases, private land. Again, it's a stair-step approach, and the legal descriptions that you'll see on those are just, they're pages long. But on the downstream side or the pool side of those properties, you're right. When the transfer was made, the Corps retained ownership of property below the exclusive flood pool on each of the reservoirs, and so that corresponds actually to an elevation. So in addition to the stair step we have on the one side, on the reservoir side, it corresponds with an elevation. So we've got two different property boundaries, two different types, and it does present challenges, no doubt.
May I follow up? So when we're addressing these grazing leases, they look very inexpensive. They do, but once you get out there and look at them, I mean, it's very complicated, and in many, many instances, that local landowner across the fence is the only option out there. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's correct. And again, it, you know, one of the things that we, you know, we find with those properties where we have just one adjoining landowner and no ability to control that boundary with a fence, you know, you think it's in a way similar to sometimes you see these school and public land tracts or BLM tracts. You know, they might be a small isolated parcel, but they're surrounded by a single ranch holding. And so these in many ways are similar to that. We only have one neighbor, and we have no way to control the boundary, and as Nathan mentioned, even access to that narrow strip of ground is a challenge in many places. So it is a, you know, when we got these lands, you know, we got the rocks with the farm as well. So
any other comments? Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin. Road right-of-way ditch mowing.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, Secretary Hepler, I'm going to make this pretty quick here.